Welcome to Philosophy Club, where lifelong friends discuss life's questions.
Let's do it.
Well, on that note, anybody got any philosophical thoughts?
I'm skimming through the doc as we speak.
I've got a throwaway one.
Let's start with that.
So it's two parts. The first part will make me sound just plain like a snob. And then I think the second part is actually a good point. So the first part is, I think the year 2000 to 2010, generally, that time frame, just a generally bad time for music, like pop music as a whole. Like the music that you'll hear on the radio, bad time. What gave me this thought is my roommate was listening to T-Pain. I didn't even know who this was. And pulled up one of his songs. And I was like, oh, this sounds like one of the generically bad songs that was around in those years. And then that got me thinking. I was like, what are some of the bands that like peaked in the 2000s time groups? And in my mind, like quintessential 2000s, this could be a reflection of like it was middle school time, was like the Black Eyed Peas. They've not aged well. Basically all their songs are unlistenable now, in my opinion. Further, they or some other bands that like peaked in the 2000s would be like, I don't know, like maybe Britney Spears. There's like that whole genre of hip hop. I think it was a tough decade for hip hop. Like that guy who just fucking played at the Super Bowl, terrible. I don't remember. I thought he'd been dead for 20 years.
Usher.
Yeah, exactly. Outkast, that whole crowd, terrible. And then the bands and groups that got their start in the 2000s, 2010s are much better in later years. So you could make the argument that like, okay, Kanye was putting out music in the 2010s. It was like, yeah, he had like one good album in that decade, like Graduation. But then he had like his real great albums, like Life of Pablo and Yeezus or whatnot. And then a couple, whatever came after that, in like 2014, 2016. And you could say like, okay, Beyonce got her start in that decade. Well, sure, she had like a couple singles, you know, like all the single ladies, but she wasn't like a great... She went from like good to great with like the album Lemonade, which is so much later. Similar with Taylor Swift. She was great for country, but she wasn't like the biggest thing in music until 1989, which was like 2012-ish or something like that. And so that's kind of the other half of it is there's the bands that are quintessential to that era are not that great. And then the bands that continued afterward, like they covered all their best stuff. All their best stuff. Like all the... Most of the best stuff in 2010s are just beaten by the same bands if the 2000s are beaten by the same bands in the 2010s to the 2020s or like currently. First, I want to hear if y'all think anything of that is true or any significant counter arguments to music 2000, 2010, generally bad era, tough era.
I don't even know where to begin. I disagree so much.
There's a lot there.
Like, really? I want it firmly on record, first and foremost, that T-Pain, in my personal opinion, arguably one of the best, like, just all-around musicians, musical geniuses, musical talents of the last 150 years. Like,
what?
The man is incredible at everything he does musically. He is fantastic. And, like, you might hate the auto-tune, but that was just what he wanted to pioneer. That's what he enjoyed. That's what he did. You listen to him write anything, him vocalize anything. Like, he is just a phenomenally talented musician.
That's what brought up is my roommate said, what about that? Remember that famous rhyme, Mansion and Wisconsin?
Wisconsin.
And I said, no one's ever done that. And he then pulled up a T-Pain song.
That's Mr. Tallahassee Pain for you. he is, I think, one of the, he is a generational musical talent. And I think Taylor Swift is the same way. I would argue that her popularity came to more with the Fearless era, not until 1989. In fact, I think she probably fell off a little bit in that era, like more into the folklore ever more later 2010s era, and that her late 2000s, early 2010s were even better than that. But that's all personal opinion on that one. But yeah, no, I think there were so many, like, I think the 90s was coming out of definitely a unique place in musical history. Like, there was all, like, the rock and roll, like the disco. There was just so many evolutions as, like, music became more electronic throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s. And into the 90s, they were just like, all right, well, let's kind of reset things. I think that's going back to our last recording. That's where the grunge scene kind of pops up. But you mean you get to the 2000s, you get a lot more of those 60s, 70s influences. You get the dad rock era, however you feel about that. But as far as like pop goes, I mean, that's like the evolution of like boy bands, like the vocal focus groups, the true pop era, kind of with what we think of pop now. And so I think that it's a critical and very important time in musical history.
You think T-Pain is one of the great geniuses of the 21st century?
Absolutely, I do.
What T-Pain songs do you think they're going to listen to in 100 years?
All of them. And, like, even if they're not, like, the thing is, too, like, he has a lot of credits on the songs that aren't his. Like, he produces a lot, he writes a lot, he does a ton of stuff in the music industry, and he does so much very well. T-Pain is fantastic.
Wow.
Like, if you haven't listened to, he has a covers, he released a covers, he goes, like, on top of the covers. That's the name of the EP or whatever. Highly listen to it. It is fantastic. He is so, so good.
That's really funny. I don't know why the weird rhyme came up, but from there, he looked it up because he knew the rhyme before he knew the person. He's like, oh, it's T-Pain. And I said, who's that? And he said, you've never heard of T-Pain? And I said, you mean the guy who wrote Common Sense, Thomas Paine? Is that who you're talking about?
Oh, and no.
And he said no. And so then he put on some of the songs. Like, oh, I remember these from like middle school dances or something, basically.
Yeah. I mean, he went very heavy with the auto-tune. Like, that's really kind of what he pioneered back in the 2000s. And like, I understand if the auto-tune is not your vibe, then that would not vibe with you. But at the same time, there is a high level of musicality that he brings and that he has done since then that is not matched.
Well, I'm going to remember the auto-tune point and we'll come back to that. One sec. Well, Ben, what are your thoughts on that era?
I think I largely agree with Ian. It sort of depends on the genre that you're looking at. I think punk had a really good 2000s. Linkin Park, Paramore, Sum 41, Green Day. I'm stuck on what you mean by a good or bad decade of music. Because if you look up pop albums released in the 2000s, you're going to find some incredible music projects. So are you just saying that the density of good music was lesser? That top 40 was worse?
I guess the top 40 is worse. I guess I'm purely, and you make a good point that there's some bands that were good bands and kind of finished out in the early 2000s that I kind of consider part of the 90s, but they did actually release stuff in the early 2000s that are notable exceptions. That's a good point. But I think that it has to do with just with a person's experience with a decade's worth of music. I think during that time, and actually even more so now, if you hear songs that were popular then or you heard from that time, they tend, in my mind, to evoke a sense that they are not very good.
Well, I also just need to point out that at one point you put Outkast and the Black Eyed Peas at the same level, and that is just horrendously offensive.
Really? Which one's better?
Oh, no. Ian, you're with me on this, right? Outkast is a generational talent.
Yes. Black Eyed Peas would put out synth, like just standard synth pop. Like they were fine. Outkast is, I would say probably I'd have them more in the 90s and the early 2000s, but like they are probably one of the top bands of that era by a long shot.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Another point here, I was listening to, this is sort of tangentially related, but I was listening to an interview about taste and what defines taste and how our taste develops. And one of this, I forget who it was, I'll check later, but one of his points was that so much of our taste is defined by what we experience during formative years, which is why traditionally so many people think the music of their childhood is just the best, and that everything that came after or before is somehow lesser. It seems like you, Logan, had just the opposite experience. And first of all, I should say, I kind of find that to be too true. I have so much nostalgia for the music that came out when I was growing up.
Oh, that's funny.
Do you not feel that to be true?
Yes, I do not feel that to be true. But part of it is that even at the time, I didn't like most of the music coming out. So when I was 15, I was listening to The Beatles and The Who and Nico and the Velvet Underground. And in most of high school, I just went off of Rolling Stone's list of best, greatest, 500 greatest albums. And that's what my music taste is based off of, is finding those and listening to those. Because I didn't like the music of the time. So his theories might still be true. It's just that I wasn't listening to, when I was that age, I was not listening to the music that was coming out. I was listening to other music. And that's still kind of like the center of my musical taste, I would say. So his point might stand.
I mean, I might be able to, I'm trying to look up 2000 songs now and form a more cohesive opinion. Like, I might be on board with the claim that pop has improved a lot since the 2000s.
I'd say pop and hip hop.
I can't speak too much to hip hop, but I would choose most of today's pop artists over what I'm seeing of 2000s pop.
Yeah.
What I would add to that point, though, is that the 2000s pop was really kind of, at least from what I've seen, like the start of what we see as pop today. Like, I think there were a bunch of, I think that's really kind of like the modern pop era, I guess, started. Because previously, I mean, it was, you might have had like a lead singer be like the name, but and then had like a backing band and whatever. But like, as kind of the single artist just being able to perform and sing with like a writing team, electronic music is the back, that really, I don't think really took off until the early 2000s. And I would say,
I agree with you, but like, if that's the case, that sort of bolsters Logan's point.
Yes.
That generally the first thing on the scene isn't the best version of that thing.
Which
time to iterate.
I was going to bring up is that I listened to a different podcast a long time ago. And after I had this discussion or this thought with T-Pain, which evidently was wildly out of place and I should relook at.
Yeah, you can't just be ashamed of yourself and all of your thoughts, Logan.
And spare.
Your opinions are bad and you should feel bad. Ignoring.
They're bad. I'm not going to feel bad about it. Anyway, the podcast was like some economist looked at the number of key changes in top 100 hits over time. And he used that as a metric for how complicated a song was and used it to argue that songs now are less complicated than they were. And I stopped the podcast, couldn't finish it, because I was like, that's fucking ridiculous. You're telling me that every time in the second to last chorus in like a 1980s Madonna song when they went up a key that made that song a more complicated song. No way. Like, I get where, like, an economist who doesn't like music that much would kind of think that, but that has no thing. And, but it, then thinking, like, what is complicated music? Where is, like, the artistry? And I feel like kind of what Ian and you are getting at, that it's the production, especially since 2000, and the proliferation of computers and the ease of digital editing makes the layering of sounds much more complicated than they used to be. And I think, like, if you listen to a Billie Eilish song, it's not usually the melody that's interesting. It's the way, it's the production, it's the layering of different sounds and stuff, for which I think that there's no theory. And that's kind of why I think that the 2000s was such a bad time, because it was kind of the beginning of that. And maybe there's some geniuses out there like Outkast and T-Pain who were able to see it for what it was. But most, the wider majority, were fumbling for dealing with the new newfound technology and techniques.
So first, we had this conversation before, because this significantly rings a bell about the number of key changes adding to... Because I remember McKinsey having some... McKinsey and I both having some firm opinions on that fact. And we're talking about the other ways that there's complexity within music. So I think we have discussed it, at least tangentially or briefly in the past. But Billie Eilish was actually an example I was thinking of when you were talking, because she's released some of her, like, raw masters of her songs that don't, I guess, necessarily sound too complex, but they've got hundreds of different audio tracks in them. And they are produced and mastered in a way that that's kind of what the focus, what the complexity is. Like, they have individual audio items for single notes, single lines of text, single instrument, like, not only single instruments, but, like, single phrases, like, so they can go in and change so much on a granular basis that, like, that is where her complexity comes in, really, in that production side. I think she is a fantastic example of that, because A, she's released her master, so we can see it, but B, because that's what she does.
That's really interesting.
Yeah,
sorry, I'm late. What are we discussing here?
We're talking about
Outkast, greatest geniuses of the 21st century. What are your thoughts?
Sorry, say that before one more time.
That T-Pain and Outkast are the greatest geniuses of the 21st century.
There's pretty good argument to be made there, I think. I mean, Outkast in particular are really excellent. T-Pain's got some great stuff, though, I gotta say. So, I mean, no strong objections here. No better candidates jump to mind. So,
but we were talking about music, and Ian was talking about Billie Eilish's production being really her mastery. Like, the complexity of her music is in the production and the layering of music for hundreds of tracks.
Isn't her brother her producer for the most part?
Yeah, I think so.
And, like, not to take away from her actual artistry, but, like, because she is fantastic too, but, like, the two of them together, like, I think that's really what drives why she is so big and why her music is so good, is because they, like, she can perform well, he can mix well, they're siblings, they know each other well, like, they really can build something great there.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
I think there might be an interesting sub-question here in how we think about the quality of certain pieces of art that were in some sense bound by the technology of their time. So the whole time we've been talking about this, I've been thinking about the Star Wars films, in particular, the first one, where the CGI is famously horrendous.
I think there can be a barrier to entry to older movies as well, particularly, like, silent films. But even so, older black and white films can be a strong barrier to entry for a lot of sort of casual movie viewers, in part because of just sort of, I think, trends and styles of the time, but also due to the fact that, like, by today's standards, some of the movies, frankly, they're not very good. You have to sort of almost limit your frame of reference to the time to be able to appreciate them for what they are.
Yeah. Well, It's like old movies, you're basically never going to get the wow, that was cool factor like you might get in an Avengers movie. And if a movie, but some of those movies got those effects at the time they came out because they were impressive for their time. And to whatever degree their popularity was based on the cool factor of their time, they're not going to be popular now.
I guess, Mike, Logan, you might be a little more in tune with this, but like, what are the current views of like the Avatar movie? Because I know that was a big one, that was going to be like a truly revolutionary movie. It's why it broke so many box office records and was, maybe still is, the highest grossing movie of all time or something. But like, looking back on it now, I feel like, I mean, I don't think it's anything super special, but yet it's still, when it was released, was one of the most notable movies in all of history.
Akeem, welcome.
What up, guys? So we're talking about movies and what, like, the aesthetic changes over time, and what was the, how'd the conversations, can some, yeah, just some background.
Ben, you want to say your question?
Well, I guess we started this conversation of Logan claiming that the 2000s was an awful decade for music and making some theory about the fact that a lot of musical techniques and ideas were just getting their start in the 2000s and that we really hadn't hit their stride in implementation. And in the 2010s, as people refined those techniques, we got a lot better output. And I pivoted that a little bit to film and how we should judge movies or any art that is in some way bound by the time it was released. And it seems like the consensus is we just have to take them for what they were when they were.
It might be useful to look at, like, I don't know, because I guess part of it is that film is a young medium, I think, in terms of art. Whereas, like, if you look at something like painting, I'm, like, by no means an expert when it comes to this, but I know that there are, I mean, we group things into certain periods, and then we classify sort of certain artists as, like, a master of this period or of this particular style. And I think that may be sort of a useful lens through which to look at this. Because something like, I mean, again, I don't know enough about the evolution of art, but I think some of, like, the highly postmodern things, it's not like you could have taken, like, a postmodern masterpiece that exists today and produced it at the height of, like, I don't know, like some sort of period of realism or something, or and it wouldn't have to be appreciated anyway. I mean, that part of that is why a lot of, like, I think artistic visionaries aren't even appreciated in their own lifetimes, because they're, like, ahead of the curve on sort of the evolutionary trends of the media. But it may be useful when it comes to this to think of, because that framework in and of itself already sort of limits the art and the artist to a sort of frame of reference in terms of when at least when evaluating their quality. What do we think about that? Does that apply to other mediums, do we think?
All right, my first thought is, how long are we going to keep saying that film is a new art? Because it's been 110 years-ish since they shot the Rocket Moon picture. No, it's D.W. Griffith was coming out with movies in like 1916. It's been a while. Movies have been doing stuff for a while. I don't think they're a young art anymore. I think we gotta put that away. They're old. Just as, not maybe the youngest, but not young anymore. That there's a difference between different movements and a lack of mastery of the medium. So, for example, the, like, Da Vinci and then Raphael, I'm mixing these up because my art history is not fantastic, but this is actually a good way to explain it. Is there was a movement in Paris in the 1870s that broke people into pre-Raphaelites and post-Raphaelites, thinking of Raphael as, like, the first person who, like, finally figured out painting and was able to depict things with all their, in all dimensions, and, like, with respect to diminishing size, things got further away, and, like, obeying all the rules of painting as we understand it now. And that's, I don't know if he exactly was the one to do it, but there was, at least historically, he's kind of associated with one who, like, kind of figured out how to paint and make something look as though it's real. Before, there's an actual lack of technical mastery. Like, not all the people don't actually know the stuff necessary to make a really top-notch painting. So if you look at stuff from, like, the medieval times, it looks flat and two-dimensional. And it might be good for its time, but it's not that good of a painting because they never developed the techniques that later came along. And then Raphael, there's typically painters learn to paint realistically very well and study the masters, and then they go into some kind of style after that. Like, it's not because Magritte couldn't make a very realistic painting that he had all of this kind of surrealist tinge to all of his stuff. He could paint a realistic painting very well. He had a mastery of the technique, and then from there, he had he went into his own individual style. So part of it is there was a lack of mastery of the technique of film that, especially like very early on, and that it's maybe, I don't know exactly where that would come in exactly, but beyond the mastery of technique, then you can start talking about eras or whatnot. But that'll never make big effects in Star Wars good.
So I agree with what you're saying to a point, but it may be the case that film as a medium is so tied to technology. We watch the movies and they're like, this is where they first figured out that if you want the audience to be able to follow a cohesive story, like if it's your exit screen right, they need to exit screen left. Because before, using like an earlier example where it's just a little more jumpy, convoluted, that I think you could argue is mastery of technique. Whereas like Star Wars has the storytelling elements down well and even the visual presentation elements down well, but the technology with which a film I think is so bound up has advanced so far as to, like, where the technological elements clearly lack or are crucial parts of the way movies look. So I guess, but with that speaking, when can we say that you've gone past the mastery of the technique is now?
When it comes to film, like I think if you can separate mastery of technique from like quality very easily. I think there's a lot of really old movies that have mastered storytelling and narrative in ways that modern filmmakers often fail to do. I think it's part of it. You can make a qualitative judgment of a film based on its, based on its sort of like the way it looks visually, and how far technology has come. But there's like people like, I still don't think most filmmakers come even close to making movies the way Akira Kurosawa did, and he was shooting in black and white. Didn't have that much technology, didn't have the insane costume and makeup and green screens that we have today. So I think part of it is just the evolution is not necessarily like a direct correlation with time. It's not like a linear sort of progression towards things are getting better necessarily. I think things are influenced by things in the past. Logan, did you ever read Harold Bloom, Anxiety of Influence? Oh, okay. So basically he talks about how like artists, he's talking about poets, but he's basically saying it's impossible for them to not be deeply influenced by their predecessors and artistically and to kind of evolve, or I don't want to say progress because it sounds like it's getting better, but to kind of like shift artistic tastes based on the past. Yeah. So I don't know if things are necessarily getting better. Like Lord of the Rings was produced what in the late 90s and early like 2000. And I still think it's from a cinematic point of view and even from a visual point of view, I think it's better than the Avengers, which came out 10 years after it.
So I would agree with a lot of that. I would say that you're right that you can't make a better quality movie than some of the great masterpieces. What was his name? Kurosawa, you said?
Yeah.
Seven
Samurai.
But...
Or Bergman.
Yeah, but I would say that Kurosawa did not have the option of making even a passably good Transformer movie.
Yeah, you know what? I think that's a healthy constraint to his creativity.
No, I think so, but that's there's a choice that previous directors make, well, actually didn't have to make, because they couldn't realize, and like, Godzilla, the old, like, first Godzilla might have been groundbreaking for its time. Tough movie to watch. Like, there's only a, you can only look past so much visual not ready right. for it. So, in that sense, yeah.
Like, but that's interesting that you say that, because Godzilla is ugly to most people now. Like, they look at it, they're like, but when people really watch a good older film, like a Kurosawa movie, like, it's still beautiful today. It's like, it's aesthetic beauty, or like Seventh Seal, for example, by Bergman. It's still, there's still scenes in it that are so powerfully beautiful, just even from a visual standpoint.
The amount that you can depict passably well is greater now. And so now there's just an even more emphasis on the choice the director has to make to limit it and understand what he can. Because now he could aliens from another universe in a spaceship fantastically well, and he has to choose what he'll do with all that ability, whereas that wasn't available.
I'm inclined to agree with that, Logan. I think it may be the case that the floor is higher now, just because, I mean, it's easier space, and it looks good. In terms of like Akiva, I love Seventh Seal, and I think that I agree with you, it still looks incredible. But I think part of that is that, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say film was, like, unique as a medium in this way necessarily, but part of what is good about film is that it, I think, feels like a cobbling together of a whole lot of other mediums. And, like, what looks great in Seventh Seal is, like, are, like, the frames of it and the shots that look like they would be excellent painting. And so the fact that it's, like, got great composition and a great storytelling, like those are two of the elements of the film, but I guess they're not the only elements. Like, some of it is just how good it looks in terms of, like, I don't know, like, even like the clarity of, like, the definition of the picture, the picture is so much greater. And it is like Seventh Seal would be better today if it were made today necessarily, but it does mean that Bergman would have more ability to control the way it looked, I guess, beyond simply the composition and the narrative. Does that make sense? I guess I'm agreeing with a little bit.
Yeah. Well, so then I think we should judge films based not by their own time, but how much they resonate with us now, because great artists and directors figured out how to express the things that are eternal and timeless, even in their own time. And those things we'll still see, even in the Kurosawa films, even in Bergman, those directors figured out how to express that to us. So we don't actually need to give them any leeway or make them any room, because they already did that for us. It still speaks to us today without us doing anything.
We can buy that.
That said, nobody could have made Everything Everywhere All at Once in the 50s. Would not have worked. Would not have been a good movie.
Very true.
Are we, any more thoughts on this?
I think we reached a reasonable conclusion.
I think I'm more or less satisfied. Yeah.
Sounds well, those are pretty good mileage out of a throwaway topic. Anybody else got something they want to talk about?
Thanks for coming to Philosophy Club. This episode was produced and edited, and its music was created by our super talented friend, Sam Roller.